Well, good afternoon and good morning, everyone. Good evening. I know we have some people also in Asia, and it's late there, but we're delighted that everyone is able to join. This is Mitchell Warren, the director of AVAC, and I'm delighted to welcome you to the next in our series of webinars on research and reality, a year-long series on all sorts of HIV prevention research to roll out updates and activities. We're particularly delighted today to welcome you not only to the Research and Reality series, but as many of you hopefully know, yesterday, officially May 18th, was HIV Vaccine Awareness Day, a day that has been recognized now for well over 20 years to look at the progress and recognize the contributions of so many people in the search for an AIDS vaccine, people in trials, people conducting trials, supporting research, funding science across the board. There were events certainly in many parts of the world yesterday, and we expect even more today given the Vaccine Awareness Day fell on a Sunday. But we're delighted to welcome you all here to a conversation about where we are in 2014 with AIDS vaccine research. The format for the call is fairly straightforward. We're going to have a presentation to kick us off from Mary Maravich, who I will introduce in just a moment. I'm then going to ask a dear friend and ally and colleague, Bill Snow, to provide some additional remarks, and I'll introduce him as well. And then hopefully we'll have a good half an hour for questions and answers with Mary and Bill, as well as a conversation. I'll give a range of instructions for how one can ask questions, both in terms of doing it on the phone and online. While you're listening to Mary's presentation, if you do have questions in real time, feel free to use the web feature, the chat feature on the website if you're logged in, or you can email avac@avac.org at any point, and we'll put those questions into the queue. And as I say, we will give additional and follow-up instructions afterwards. So with that, it's really a tremendous pleasure to introduce Mary Maravich to kick us off with a presentation on breakthroughs and big questions in AIDS vaccine research. For, I guess, just over a year now, Mary has been the director of the Vaccine Research Program at the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is part of the U.S. National Institutes of Health, and she officially sits within the Division of AIDS. So if you get all of those acronyms right, DAIDS at NIAID at NIH, you will be situated well. Mary has been at the NIH leading the vaccine research program, as I say, for just over a year, but has a long history in the field, having come to the NIH from the U.S. Military HIV Research Program, MHRP, as it's fondly known, where she was the chief of vaccine R&D for 8 years. As you will hear in Mary's presentation, and as you will all undoubtedly know by virtue of being on this call, the MHRP has been really groundbreaking in their vaccine research, having led the so-called RV144 trial, which we'll hear more about and the follow-up of it from Mary in just a minute. So Mary comes with a long background in vaccine research, and we're delighted that she's now at the Division of AIDS directing the vaccine research program. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to you, Mary, and we'll go ahead and advance your slides as you go, and I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you, Mitchell. I assume everyone can see the slides, and thank you so much for the wonderful introduction, and welcome to everyone on the call. Thanks for your interest. Okay, we can go to slide 2. You can advance right away. Are you there?
It's there, Mary.
Okay.
It sometimes may be a little slow, but you can go ahead and get started, but it's definitely advancing.
Okay. So I would like to come out pretty strongly and say that the future of HIV vaccines is bright. There have been several breakthroughs in the last 5 years that have kind of converged, and I really think we're closer than ever. The first, as Mitchell had alluded to, probably the biggest breakthrough that we've had in the last 5 years is the efficacy signal that was seen in RV144, and I'll talk about that more. There's been a lot of advances in new technology that have helped us to identify viral targets, so sort of weak points on the virus where antibodies can then target that area and help prevent infection. Along those lines, we have now learned that humans, those infected with HIV, can actually make broadly neutralizing antibodies, and those antibodies have actually been shown in animal experiments to prevent infection. So it's encouraging that the human body can make these broadly neutralizing antibodies, and we have hopes one day that we can have a vaccine that would elicit those. And then finally, there's been some major breakthroughs in the area of CD8 T cells. There have been vaccines that induce very potent and effective CD8 T cells that have actually shown protection of non-human primates and have also shown clearance of established infection in primates. So I'll cover all those areas, and we can go to the next slide if you would. Okay, so this is the outline of my talk. We will talk first about the RV144 efficacy signal. As I mentioned, it was the first vaccine to study that showed an acquisition effect, meaning that HIV infections were prevented. There is correlates work that is ongoing, but we have learned a lot so far about that, and I'll touch on that. And there are studies that are planned, of course, to extend and substantiate the results of RV144. The next topic will be on broadly neutralizing antibodies, and many of you are probably aware that 5 years ago or so, 8 years ago, we just had a handful of antibodies. Now we have hundreds of new broadly neutralizing antibodies, and again, they seem to be focused on some 4 to 5 areas of weakness on the virus surface itself. I've listed those out: the MPER region, the CD4 binding site, the glycan V3 region, and V1, V2, and others now. Even newer sites are coming. The important thing is that these broadly neutralizing antibodies are produced by the human immune repertoire. So that means that we can make these antibodies. We just need to develop a vaccine that could induce them because they've only been induced by infection thus far. And I also have some very exciting news along these lines with broadly neutralizing antibodies, and I'll get to that later. And then finally, we'll touch on the T-cell immunogens, along the lines of CD8 T-cell protection. Again, talking about a vaccine that's in development now. It's not quite ready for human trials. It's called CMV. And that vaccine in the primates has, once given to animals, has been able to clear their infection in about half of the animals, and that's a very consistent finding. And then other viral vectors have actually induced enough CD8 T-cells that have protected them. Okay, we can go to the next slide. So just like Mitchell was saying, we want to have a reality check. I love that idea, and, you know, sort of getting back to the basics. You know, we know we need a vaccine. How long does it take to make a vaccine? And if you can see the slide here on the left, I have listed some diseases, and on the right, how long it took to develop a vaccine. So once we knew what caused, say, polio, if you look in the middle of the slide, we knew what type of virus it was. 30 years later, we were able to have a vaccine. You can see that sometimes it took decades, and others it took even longer. So while HIV is a particularly challenging virus because of the way it mutates, we still believe a vaccine will be found. And we're still working within a time frame that's comparable to other diseases. And as I mentioned, I think we're closer than ever. So we can go to the next slide. Do vaccines work? You know, is it worth the wait type deal? So I always ask people on this slide, you know, when was the last time you saw a case of diphtheria or a case of, you know, measles? I mean, in some parts of the world, okay, we are still struggling with these diseases. But in areas where there's good uptake of vaccines, we don't see a lot of these diseases anymore. And people forget, I think, how effective and helpful vaccines have been over the years. So this is just a little reminder and reality check slide that I like that shows just how effective vaccines are. Okay, we can go to the next slide. So how do vaccines work? How do they do their job? And this graphic shows that most effective vaccines work by inducing antibodies. And if you look at the lower right-hand side, the Y-shaped blue piece is meant to be an antibody. And these antibodies are proteins that are directed against the viral surface. And a vaccine can induce these antibodies that can then bind to the virus and block entry and limit infection. I do want to remind people that we have the hepatitis B vaccine on the right here, and that was, here we're showing antibodies, influenza in the middle. Now remember, influenza is a pretty variable virus, and the way we deal with influenza is we have to have influenza vaccines on an annual basis because of the variability. And this might be, you know, and this is clearly an issue for HIV is all the variability, but we're hoping, again, to make antibodies that can protect us. Okay, let's go to the next slide. So what about the breakthroughs? That's what we wanted to talk about today. So let's go to the RV144 efficacy signal, the box I have on top. We can go to the next slide. This was just an outline slide. So I'm hoping what you have in front of you is the RV144 graphic, and most of you are probably familiar with the curve, what we call Kaplan-Meier curves, on the left-hand side of this graphic. What you can see along the x-axis are years, the time since vaccination, and on the y-axis is the probability of HIV-1 infection. And on top, you see the placebo curve in red, and beneath that, you see the vaccine curve. And what this shows is that these two curves are completely separate throughout the course of the vaccine study, and it showed that there was a statistically significant decrease in acquisition in those participants who were vaccinated. And the number that we always throw around, because the study was designed to look at efficacy after 3 years, which is a long time, was 31%. And you can look at the box on the right, the table, and if you look at the time point, 36, and you go across, it's 30.42%. But one thing that wasn't specified in advance but was looked at after the study was completed is that at the one-year time point, which I have circled in the graphic, and I have a bar around it in the table, is that the vaccine efficacy is thought to be about 60% at the one-year time point in RV144, and then that efficacy waned over time. And that's thought to be consistent with antibody levels that it dropped over time. So we're hopeful that if we could increase the effect of RV144 and maybe make those antibodies stay around, we might have a much more efficacious vaccine. Okay, so what more did we learn from RV144? If you go to the next slide, here I show a graphic about RV144 antibody correlates. And sometimes the correlates can be confusing, but what we are trying to do is learn what worked or how it worked in a vaccine. And so there were a lot of laboratory measurements that were made, and we tried to correlate those with people who did or didn't get infected. And what they found was, again, you'll see the antibody in red, the Y-shaped antibody that's looking like it's going to attach to the virus on the left-hand side of the graphic. And what they suggest was that antibodies to the V2 region, so a variable part of the envelope that's shown on the right-hand side in very high magnification, antibodies correlated with a decreased infection risk. So that means if you had antibodies to the V1, V2 region, this particular region, you were less likely to become infected. And that's what's called a negative correlate, because it meant you were less likely to become infected. Okay, we can go to the next slide. So what were we going to do after RV144? Many of you have probably heard about the P5 series of studies, and I wanted to talk about that a little bit because there has been delays in these studies. I usually ask people what would they like to do if they had a vaccine that showed some efficacy, and most people say they would like to see those results verified or extended. And that's exactly what the P5 partnership was meant to do, was to substantiate and extend the RV144 result in high incidence populations, both in Africa and in Southeast Asia. It is a partnership, what we call a public-private partnership, and the main groups involved are the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the NIH as funders, and then the companies involved are Novartis, Sanofi Pasteur, and more recently, GlaxoSmithKline has agreed to provide an adjuvant called ASO1B, along with the U.S. Military Research Program and critical linkages to the Medical Research Council of South Africa. The implementers of these studies will be the HVTN, the HIV Vaccine Trials Network. And if you go to the next slide, I have a little more detail on where these studies will be conducted and what vaccines we'll be using. So again, the P5 partnership has actually two tracks of studies. There are many studies involved, some very small studies and some larger studies. But on the left-hand side, you can see what's called the licensure track. And that study will try to remain as true to RV144 with the LVAC vector and the protein boost, except that this time it will use an insert that is more representative for the viruses circulating in Africa with clade C. So on the left, you can see products involved will be LVAC, HIV, VCP2438, which is just basically the numbers that refer to the clade C insert, along with the proteins, which will be reflective of that area as well. And then they'll use an MF59 adjuvant that will be provided by Novartis along with the proteins. And you can see the partners and the networks on the lower left-hand side and the geography of that slide. Now, something that you may hear less about, of course, is the correlates or the discovery or the research track. And here what the investigators are setting out to do is to improve and slightly modify the regimen, the vaccine regimen, to see if they can get it to be even better than 50% or 60%. And on that part of the slide there, you see they're using DNA along with another pox vector, it's called NIVAC, and a protein boost. And in the research or the correlates studies, there are many smaller studies which will help us down select which of the different adjuvants or whether we need both DNA and NIVAC, et cetera. So the regimen is going to be defined as they move through those research studies on the right-hand side, and the partners in geography and network are shown below. So these studies have well-defined go, no-go criteria that need to be met in order to move into advanced studies, 2B or phase 3 studies. And those studies, the early phase 1 studies for the P5 will start in early 2015. We're hoping approximately January or February 2015 to start in Southern Africa. Okay, we can go to the next slide. So what about the broadly neutralizing antibodies? I want to move into that category because this is another major breakthrough. As I told you, there's been many, many new broadly neutralizing antibodies identified due to some improvements in technology. We have multiple viral targets or weaknesses on the virus where we know if we attack that site with neutralizing antibodies, the virus is ineffective. And we also know that they're produced by the human repertoire. What I'd like to show on the next slide, if you advance the slide, is a graphic of these sites of vulnerability. And if you look on the way this slide is oriented is the cell would be at the top of the slide, and the virus would be coming in from the bottom, attacking that cell. And you can see where the arrows are. I've pointed out some of these major areas of weakness on the virus. You can see, for example, on the lower right, the CD4 binding site in yellow, the V3 glycan loop in blue, the V1, V2 area in green, and then the membrane proximal external region, that MPR region that's very close to the cell where the virus comes in. These are areas where investigators are trying to make antibodies directed towards those regions so that we can then develop a vaccine that would elicit those. If you go to the next slide, this is the basic bottom line for vaccine development as we talk about neutralizing antibodies. We know that with infection, the human's immune repertoire can make these neutralizing antibodies. And if we work backwards from that neutralizing antibody, we can identify a neutralizing epitope and say, okay, what do we need to make these antibodies? What type of immunogen do we need? And in the next slide, I can tell you how we've gone about doing that. So using the neutralizing antibody approach to prevent HIV infection, there's really three main strategies. If you look on the far right-hand side of this slide called the provision of neutralizing antibodies, many of you may know that there are active studies going on now in humans where we're actually infusing some of these broadly neutralizing antibodies to understand how they behave within the body, what types of levels we can achieve, et cetera. So there's studies ongoing with VRC01, for example, in humans, an antibody that's been identified at the NIH. There's also what we call gene-based vectors or vectored immunoprophylaxis, which is a long way of saying that they've taken a small virus, AAV virus, and put an insert in there that tells the virus to make the neutralizing antibody. And they then inject the virus into volunteers. This study is going on in the UK through IAVI. And those people are making antibodies that way. So that's where we sort of provide the antibody. We're not asking the person to make those antibodies, really. On the left-hand side, where we're talking about on this graphic more the vaccine approach, here we're trying to use the structure to inform a vaccine component, and then we would give the vaccine to induce those antibodies. And in the middle portion of the curve, we're taking an immune-based approach and saying, how is it that we engage the B cells to make those antibodies and drive the antibody maturation? So it's really a three-pronged approach to develop these neutralizing antibodies. On a real positive note, I want to get to the next slide, because many of you may know that these neutralizing antibodies, yes, while they're very potent and they're broad, it's often said that only about 20% of the infected population actually generate these antibodies. It also takes a long time to generate these antibodies. It takes several years, and that's why they're not very effective in HIV infection. But there was a recent study that was published just this year in AIDS 2014, and I have the reference down on the lower right-hand side of the slide, where they have now looked at hundreds of people who are infected with HIV, and they found that actually most people do make modestly neutralizing antibodies. They may be much more common than we think. And there's a spectrum of responses. So what we were focusing on were these 20% of elite neutralizers. But if you really look at all comers, many people are on that spectrum. And most sera from infected persons show some level of cross-neutralizing antibody effect. And what the bottom line of this study said, that about half of the sera will neutralize half of the viruses. And the titers of neutralization were correlated with the breadth, so the potency was correlated with the level of cross-reactivity. And many sera had breadth to several comparable to several of these less potent broadly neutralizing antibodies. So the bottom line here is that this is really good news for vaccine-induced antibodies. And we're hoping that we can elicit those perhaps at low levels. And fortunately, low levels have been shown to be effective. So with adjuvanting and better vaccines, we're hopeful that we can get to this modest level of neutralization. Okay, so let's go on to the final area of breakthrough that I wanted to talk about, which is the T-cell immunogens. And if you go to the next slide, I can review that data with you. So you should have the title of a Nature paper there that says Immune Clearance of Highly Pathogenic SIV Infection. Now, this was a paper published by Lewis Picker, and he's had several papers along these lines. And he uses a live CMV vaccine, which is a human pathogen that causes persistent infection, but most people are fine with that type of infection. He has a rhesus version of that vector, and in it he's placed SIV antigens and shown that this type of vaccine strategy induces very potent CD8 T-cell responses that once these animals are challenged after vaccination, half of these animals are consistently able to clear the infection. They know the animals were actually infected, but through this very strong CD8 T-cell response, they can get it so that their viral loads are down and that they're no longer able to find virus in the animals after long periods of time. So this is a sustained level of clearance. And this obviously has implications for preventative and therapeutic vaccines. And so there's a lot of active research going on in this area. If you go to the next slide, I'll show you a graphic for those of you who may appreciate seeing things visually. So again, this is a rhesus CMV SIV vector that controls SIV challenge. As I mentioned, the key finding is that about half of the animals cleared infection through effector memory CD8 T cells. If you look at the graph on the left with the blue and red lines, you can see that out of 16 animals that were vaccinated, once they were challenged, about half of the animals in blue were non-controllers. So they just show the regular SIV viral load curve. But the other half of the animals, 9 out of those 16, bring their viral load down fairly quickly, and then you can see a few blips, but eventually all the viral load comes down and eventually they begin to clear their antibodies and they begin to look like they haven't been infected. On the right is just a control to show that all the animals do actually get infected. So this is a very exciting area of research, and down the road, once a humanized CMV vaccine with HIV inserts is developed, it will be brought into the clinical arena. If you can go to the next slide. I guess this is my penultimate slide, and I wanted to bring some questions forward, because I think that was the second part of the title is to review the breakthroughs and then the big questions. So major questions I think that we need to address going forward are antibody durability. With the P5 suite of studies, can we generate that level of antibody that was seen at the first year that provided a lot of protection? Can we have that antibody stick around? So increasing durability. And then also we need to learn more about the quality of the different types of antibodies that are produced and their binding effects. And we also need to make sure that we're inducing antibodies at the mucosal surfaces where the virus is transmitted. And last, I think we need to really focus on neutralizing activity. Can we get vaccines that elicit neutralization, and how can we improve that and optimize that as we move forward? So those are my major questions, and that's my, I guess my next slide is my last slide, if you can advance it, where I just say thank you for your attention and your
commitment to HIV vaccine development. And that's all I have. Thanks.
Great. Mary, thank you so much. That is an enormous amount. So not just all you have, but a really terrific overview of the state of the field, and one that I think really will spark a number of questions and conversations, we hope. And again, we'll open the lines in just a minute. In the meantime, if you do have questions, you can type them into the web feature or email them to avac@avac.org. And as you're thinking about questions and what you want to raise with Mary and with each other, I do want to first turn to Bill Snow, who anyone working in AIDS vaccine R&D knows very well. Decades-long engagement, certainly as one of AVAC's founders, and more recently as the executive director of the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise. And I thought before we open it up for questions, I might turn to Bill for his own reflections at 20-plus years into his advocacy and engagement with the field and the last couple of years leading the enterprise. And want to just turn over to you, Bill, for any thoughts or reflections.
Thank you, Mitchell. Can you hear me?
I can indeed.
Okay, great. So, Mary, that was really good. You did a very nice job, and it was very clear, and I don't want to take very much time away from questions. There's a couple of points I would like to make, because I think they'd be interesting to the advocates on the line. One is that people are starting, in addition to the four targets that Mary mentioned, which are sort of the canonical targets, people are beginning to discover that other parts of the virus surface are also susceptible, and that very often that involves the sugars on the outside of the virus as well as the virus itself. The other point I wanted to make was for those of you who don't get it or haven't heard it in the past, but the reason that broadly neutralizing antibodies are important is because if you vaccinate someone, you don't know exactly what virus is going to infect them. So if you can only protect against one virus, then any other virus can come in and infect them, and that's just not adequate. And that's actually what happens in infection, is that the first thing the body does is make antibodies against the infecting virus. And getting that breadth is something that we know, at least in the natural state, takes a fair amount of time. So one challenge is to speed that up. Another thing I just want to say is that if you want to watch for progress, you should look for approaches to induce those antibodies. There's several that are in the conceptual stage, and they're going to begin to be tested very soon. And I want to emphasize the importance of this period going forward and of holding the course, because we won't be having efficacy trial results again for a number of years, but we will be setting the stage for much more effective candidates. And we have to get through this sort of curve that's going upward rather than in a straight line and sort of taking a dip and going up again. I think you all know why a vaccine is so important for ending the epidemic. And the prevention options that we have now are important for controlling it now. But we need to keep this going forward. So watch for new developments. They will continue to happen apace. That there's always new developments. There's a lot of really smart people working on this. And in the end of October, we're going to have the new prevention conference, R4P, and that will be webcast. So I would encourage you to either attend or watch the webcasts of the vaccine sessions. Thank you.
Great, Bill. Thank you so very much. And thanks to both you and Mary again for terrific stage setting. As you will see here on the slide, a number of ways to engage in the conversation through the chat feature online. You can email at avac@avac.org, or I would love for people to ask their questions directly. You can hit *7 to unmute your line. We would ask that you hit *6 to mute it again, as we are taping the call, and we're going to put this on the website for archival purposes. With that, I will go ahead and open the line, and first I'll check to see if there are any questions straight away. Again, star 7 to unmute your line. Well, let me first start while people are either getting off mute or sending in via electronic forms. I did want to come back, Mary. You had raised this issue, which I think is so interesting and important, about the various neutralizing antibody approaches, and wondered if you could describe a little bit more, and I'm going to actually maybe go back in the slides that you did, of the two different approaches. If you might just want to spend another minute about what are some of the trials that are currently happening. You mentioned them very briefly, but I wanted to give people a sense, particularly on the right-hand side, you talked about this provision of antibodies, and I wonder if you might just give a sense of the differences from the conventional views of vaccines as we've often thought of them.
Okay. Thanks, Mitchell, and thanks, Bill, for those great comments. I guess I'm back on slide 15. I think that's the one you're referring to.
Yes, exactly, and I have it up on the screen for people who are still on the website.
Okay, great. And this idea of provision of neutralizing antibodies is actually a pretty old concept. Back in the day, that's how. Well, we still use it for certain exposures, right? For rabies, we provide passive immunoglobulins that are directed against rabies while we give the person a vaccine. It was used way back in the past for tetanus exposure, et cetera. So basically, what we're doing here is we're taking antibodies, that were made in someone else and basically making monoclonal antibodies, but in the laboratory, and then infusing them into people. And this is a common therapy today is antibody therapy. Some of you may be aware of using that for treatment of rheumatoid arthritis or different things. The antibody therapy is very common now. And the problem is their half-lives aren't very long, so you have to get, frequent injections every month or every couple months. But basically, you infuse these antibodies and you measure them in the blood to see if they're at high enough levels, what we would think would be high enough levels, to prevent infection. That's called passive transfer of antibodies. And the second approach that's being studied now is really what I find very creative and, to my knowledge, is a new approach where they actually put a cassette inside of a viral vector, just like we make other viral vectors for vaccination, except this time they put it in so that when that genetic information is translated inside the human body, they inject the vector into the muscle. That makes an antibody itself, and those antibodies then circulate. So a neutralizing antibody called PG9 has been inserted into an AAV vector, and that study is being conducted, as I mentioned, in London in the UK. And there they're saying, okay, does this work? Are they able to make those antibodies, and what types of levels are achieved, and how long will they stick around? Will the body accept those antibodies? Will they make antibodies against that? There's a lot of work that needs to be done there. How do you turn off that vector if you need to? How long does it last? There's a lot of important research questions going on in these early phase studies, but I found that to be a very sort of creative way almost force the body to make those antibodies. Are there other questions on
that? No, that's terrific.
Okay.
And we did just have a question that came in on a different topic, on the follow-up to RV144 that just came in from a colleague. And as you described, there'll be trials both in Thailand and South Africa in the licensure study, potentially. And a lot of questions historically in the field about the subtypes or clades of HIV and the differences there and whether they matter and whether we'll have to have different vaccines in different regions. And a question came in asking if in this P5 program, given that they're slightly different vaccines that you described, if it's possible that one might work in South Africa, but it would be a different vaccine that would be delivered in Thailand, for example.
Oh, sure. That's a great question. And there has been a lot of discussion about that. You know, was the reason that RV144 worked was because there's really very a very homogeneous type of virus that circulates there that was closely matched to the insert in the vaccine, the sort of CRF01 or AE type virus. It is very possible that there would be clade specific protection, and that is why for the P5 studies moving into Africa, the inserts were changed, and the inserts there to be studied in southern Africa reflect the most common circulating strains there, which is subtype C. To address perhaps the question that you're talking about in a way that we could, there's a study going on in South Africa currently, and I think they might have completed vaccinations, where they actually took the exact RV144 regimen, so the subtype AE regimen, and injected a small number of people in a phase one study in South Africa just to make sure that they were sort of responding similarly. And then we'll come in with the actual clade C virus that's matched for the epidemic in southern Africa, and we can compare notes really between those responses just to make sure things are similar in different countries. So that was one way of controlling it. The other idea is that let's say the clade C, let's just think, you know, dream for success. Let's say it does show protection in southern Africa now that we have the inserts matched for southern Africa. What about all the other places? Are we going to have to make vaccines to address? And that is possible, but there are other areas of study that are so-called clade independent. So some of the vaccines that are coming down the road are trying to address that issue, and one of them is called a mosaic vaccine. And again, I didn't get into this very well, but on the terrific AVAC website, they do talk about this as the the AD26 protein MVA study that will be run through J&J and a lot of other partners. They have mosaic inserts, which should be clade independent. So it means that they've taken a lot of genetic information that should be representative of all the different clades. And there are other approaches where you mix and match. You prime with one subtype and you boost with another so you can broaden the response. I'm not sure if I answered the question, but
no, you did really, you did beautifully, Mary. That is terrific, and I did want to just, as Mary described, some of this, the updates on the pipeline is currently available on the AVAC website through this year's vaccine awareness toolkit that includes one-page advocates updates on a number of issues, including the issues of passive transfer and neutralizing antibody research, as well as updates on RV144 and the entire pipeline. So, that is terrific. Another question came in, actually, maybe for both Bill and Mary. You know, historically, we've talked about AIDS vaccines and Vaccine Awareness Day being very much about preventive vaccines. And a question came in from a colleague asking about where the conversations might be with respect to both preventive and therapeutic vaccines, and how are they differing, and how are therapeutic vaccines advancing? And I don't know, Bill, I know, you know, the Enterprise just led through its Timely Topic series a meeting about therapeutic vaccines, if you wanted to kick off with a start on that.
Yeah, sure. Can you hear me again?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So, yeah, we did hold a meeting. Actually, our partners were TAG and AVAC last fall to talk about this very question, about what the similarities and differences might be between a vaccine for to protect someone from getting infected and a vaccine that would help someone who already is infected. And there's been a revival of interest in this in the first J generation of work, not much was achieved by trying the same vaccines in infected people. But now with the cure, with the option of a cure agenda, if one had a therapeutic vaccine that was on board when you activated the reservoir, it might actually help clear the virus in an infected person in a way that gave a functional cure. The other point that I'd like to make is that probably an antibody vaccine, which is the sort of the holy grail of preventive vaccines, is not going to work for someone who's already been infected and whose virus has been spitting out antibodies for years. So it would probably be the CMV vaccine or one of these approaches that actually generates broadly neutralizing antibodies artificially that would work in infected people.
Great. Thanks, Bill. That's a super summary. Mary, do you want to add anything on that topic?
No, I think okay. Bill did a great job.
Great. And another question came in on a series of vaccines from the History Bank. And something I know, Mary, you and colleagues at DAIDS have been very involved with, but a series of trials related to the Adeno 5 vector, I think people are well aware, and did not work. And someone just asked a question because you were talking about one of these other adenos, AD26, that is still being developed, and wanted just clarity about the differences between these other adenos still in development and the AD5 vector, and whether the AD5 vector was still something that advocates should pay attention to.
Okay, I'll take this one then.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that question. I kind of toyed with the idea whether I was going to talk about 505 or others, but I thought I wouldn't be able to get through all the breakthroughs, but I'm glad you brought it up. So from an NIH standpoint, we have come to the conclusion that Adeno-5 HIV vaccines are not going to move forward. We, at a minimum, we thought that those vaccines didn't work. There's been 3 efficacy studies with them that did not show that they worked, and there's always that lingering concern with STEP, at least, that there may have been some increased risk of infection in certain subpopulations in that study. So we have chosen not to pursue AD5 HIV vaccines. But there are other what they call alternative adenovirus vaccines, and the one I referred to earlier was that AD26 vaccine. There's been an argument made that those vaccines may behave quite differently from Adeno-5. They have different cellular targets. They have different responses, the immune system responds to them differently, and they might not induce as much activation that we think may have played a role in the inefficacy, at least, of the AD5 vaccines. I would refer you, if you want more information on that, we did a mini-summit on Adeno-5 vaccines. And that is online, and it's very high quality. You can hear good discussions, and the slides look well. It would be a webinar type, not, of course, as good as the AVEX, but it's a pretty good one and worth watching if you're interested. And then also we wrote a position paper on that came out in Science, I think, earlier this year. Dr. Fauci is on that paper, where we talk about, it's a two-pager, it's not too long, and it could give you sort of the bottom line on how we feel about different adenos. But our point is, for AD5 HIV, we're not using it anymore. For alternate ads, we think we could proceed with caution, so long as there's frequent checks and balances on that vaccine. They may behave differently, and they may be able to move forward.
Great. Mary, that is a super summary, and I think one of the clearest statements of where we are with respect to adeno-based vaccines that I've heard. So that's incredibly helpful. I have a couple of more in, and then we'll maybe open up the line. I realize we're getting toward the top of the hour. But a great question came in from a partner here in the U.S. In the conversation about the neutralizing antibodies that you were describing, particularly on the passive transfer, she was asking if people who receive those antibodies who are HIV negative as part of a prevention trial, if having the antibodies would have them test positive in a standard HIV antibody test.
Oh, great question. These are, okay, that's a really great question. I'm going to say no right off the bat, but I could be wrong on that. These are pretty specific antibodies directed towards a very, sort of area of the HIV envelope. So I would say they're directed towards like a piece of GP120. But I could be mistaken on that. I just don't think they're going to show up on the diagnostic assays. But I'll have to say that I've never had that question before. I think it's a very good one, and I'm going to say no, but I need to check.
Okay. No, that's great, because actually, funny enough, just as you were answering it, another colleague in South Africa wrote in, and this is an issue that, again, the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise had one of its timely topic sessions on.
Okay.
This idea of the vaccine-induced seropositivity, and she was asking, particularly in South Africa, where so many of these trials are being planned, how we, the field, and I guess the HVTN and NIAID in leading those trials, how do you deal with that issue for the other vaccine candidates that may have this vaccine-related HIV test positive, even though one is negative, and how that gets managed or handled through the trials?
Okay, well, that's a big area of research, and of course, Bill may want to comment on this as well. But we did have a big meeting. Bill obviously was totally involved with the timely topics with what is called this vaccine-induced seropositivity. And this has been, from my experience as being an investigator in the field, and obviously folks on the phone are going to know this from being in the field, is this is one of the major concerns for folks who are uninfected in joining a trial. The good news is we can say that the testing is so sophisticated now, we can clearly delineate who's infected, who's not. Obviously, someone who has antibodies and no virus, we can prove that they're not infected. And some of the diagnostics now, these fourth generation ELISA tests can differentiate as well. But what we do to manage it is we have an open protocol for anyone who's received an HIV vaccine. They can be followed, and particularly those who seroconverted or who remain antibody positive. And we have done advocacy for those volunteers. Mary Ellen, who works at the Division of AIDS, has been dedicated to this for years. We had a hotline where people could call in, and then if they had a job interview or an issue where they were being tested, we could intervene generally with a letter that would say this person has been in a vaccine trial. But we do have infrastructure and staff committed to that. And like I say, it is a negative, but we can always prove that someone's not infected.
Great. Thanks, Mary Bill. Did you want to add anything to that?
No, Mary nailed it. Thank you.
Great. And I should say, for those interested in any of these topics that I mentioned where the Vaccine Enterprise had its timely topic series, I direct you to the HIV Vaccine Enterprise website, hivvaccineenterprise.org, and you'll see a section about the timely topics and many of these various meetings and conversations on some of the hot topics in the field right now are listed. Again, I know we're at the top of the hour, and I had a bunch more questions still to come, and but one actually very interesting one just came in that you mentioned, Mary, a number of products to be tested, and a question from someone saying, are these products actually available and ready to test? And I think that might be particularly related to the trials following on RV144 and perhaps even some of the other issues you discussed. Are there actual vaccine candidates manufactured and ready for testing?
Okay, that's another great question. Thanks for bringing that up. So for the P5, the products that are involved just in general,
would be, of course, the LVAC-based vaccines for the licensure study that we're talking about, so the 144-like regimen with the clade C inserts. That product is manufactured. It's in the bulk drug substance form that's manufactured by Sanofi. That just has to be vialed and released. The other portion of that vaccine is a protein that's being made by Novartis. And Novartis is in the final stages of producing those proteins. Honestly, the protein production has been the much more difficult aspect of making these vaccines and has been a major source of delay for these studies. Otherwise, the studies would have gone forward earlier. And it turns out that the production of these envelope proteins is fairly complicated. Making an HIV envelope protein is not easy. It's complicated, and as Mitchell had alluded to earlier, Bill, there's a lot of sugars that are on the surface of this protein, so it's not just a protein. It's a glycosylated protein, and that can be kind of tricky to handle in the laboratory. But Novartis is a well-known vaccine company who's been working on this for a long time, and they're in the final stages of producing that protein, which we believe will be released in the fall, I believe September 2014, and then ready for study in January or February. The other products, the DNA and the adjuvants, are much more readily available and accessible. As I mentioned, the protein is just the one that's slowed us down.
So, Mary, may I add something? Mitchell? Sorry.
Go ahead, Bill.
Oh, please go ahead,
yeah.
Bill.
You should also remember that there are a number of totally different approaches that are moving forward in phase one and a couple in phase two where there's product available and we're getting immunogenicity data. And those are being run by the HVTN and by IAVI and by the MHRP mostly and some European groups.
Great. Thanks, Bill. And again, I'll direct people one of the new updated fact sheets on AIDS vaccine science for busy advocates actually provides an overview of the current R&D pipeline of what products are in trials and you can see that again at avac.org/HVAD. We're just at the top of the hour, and there was one really important and I think incredibly timely question that I thought might be a good one to raise before we actually close, and that relates to the evolving landscape in which vaccine trials take place. And perhaps most notably, I think, for a lot of advocates over the last week was the release last week from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention with respect, at least here in the United States, of a recommendation and guidance for oral pre-exposure prophylaxis with Truvada for PrEP. And a question actually came in from a number of different quarters asking this in different countries, what would these vaccine trials look like that you've described, Mary, in terms of the potential standard of prevention that is provided to trial participants in the years to come with the rapidly evolving landscape?
Oh, yeah, that's another great question. And I had something on that, too, which I took out with regard to 505. We actually addressed this in 505. It's probably not well appreciated, but once Truvada became approved, so for the most recent DNA adeno5 vaccine study that was stopped last year about this time, we actually offered or had the provision for PrEP in the latter stages of that study once it became approved. And we do have some data on the uptake of that, and we, moving forward, would, of course, continue to offer PrEP because it's a prevention modality that has been shown to be effective. So I believe oral PrEP will be offered as it was in 505 moving forward. The uptake was about 5.9%, if I recall correctly. But again, people know the uptake on PrEP has been slow, but it'll probably increase over time. And as we've done with all other prevention modalities, counseling, circumcision, male circumcision, condoms, et cetera,
those are all prevention modalities that have to be provided to participants.
Great. Thank you so much, Mary. Fantastic, clear answer. Bill, anything to add on that?
Yeah, this is actually a pretty complicated issue that's being discussed in a lot of quarters. One of the complications, of course, is that PrEP is only approved in the United States.
It's still a good point. Thank you.
And in most countries where the epidemic is serious, they're having a hard time just getting drugs for people who are infected. So I don't see that happening soon. And then it becomes a different kind of a question, and the people who design the trials need to figure out how to deal with it.
Yeah, thank you for that. I needed to mention that was 505 was conducted in the USA and it is approved in the USA. Thanks, Bill.
You know, it's a great point and a space I think for all advocates to be watching. And I think particularly I know a lot of our partners are on the line from South Africa, which is clearly based on your presentation, Mary, a place where lots of research will happen. And Gilead has filed for approval in South Africa for oral PrEP. And we look forward to results next year from both tenofovir gel and two efficacy trials looking at the dapivirine vaginal ring. So it is, as ever, a complicated and exciting landscape in which vaccine research takes place. I realize we are just past the hour. I do want it, and there's some other questions that we'll continue to come back to in advocacy for many months and years to come. I do want to just give both Bill and Mary a quick chance for any last thoughts in terms of issues and ideas for the way forward. So maybe I'll start with you, Bill.
No, just thanks for the call, Mitchell. It's been terrific.
Thank you, Bill. And Mary, any thoughts?
No, just I hope everyone had a good HIV Vaccine Awareness Day, and thanks so much for your attention and dedication to this.
Great. Well, thank you both so very much. I do want to thank both of you sincerely for being part of this call, and to thank all of you for joining. And I do want to make an official apology. I made a mathematical error, as I am wont to do. I'm reminded by a dear friend that although vaccine advocacy has been around since the day people knew about HIV 30-plus years ago and began to think about an AIDS vaccine, Vaccine Awareness Day officially began in 1997. I just did bad math. And it actually began, I think, important for people to remember when, at the time, then-President Bill Clinton was giving a commencement address at Morgan State University on May 18, 1997, and Vaccine Awareness Day then began each year after that. And he said then that let us commit ourselves to developing an AIDS vaccine within the next decade. Something I know many people have heard many times over many decades. It will be another decade. And he said, there are no guarantees. It will take energy and focus and demand great effort from our greatest minds. And that was as true in 1997 as it is today. As I often say, I still think we're a decade away from an AIDS vaccine. It just depends on when you start counting. And it's clear that while Mary and Bill described an enormous amount of energy and excitement in the field, there is so much more work to be done. And I just will say that anyone who's looking for a great speech to read, President Clinton's Morgan State commencement address really is incredible. And he said that at the end, but the strides of recent years, it's no longer a question of whether we can develop an AIDS vaccine. It is simply a question of when, and that was well before we had all of the excitement scientifically that Mary described since 1997. So still a long road still to go, but many new indicators and markers along the way. Again, there are a range of materials from all sorts of organizations, from NIAID, the Enterprise, IAVI, the MHRP partners at the HVTN throughout, so please make use of those. And actually, if you go to avac.org/HVAD, you will find some of these advocate tools for advocacy and understanding AIDS vaccine research, and we'll also see in the overall slide set on AIDS vaccines, the basics, a list of all of the different resources online. And if you have any questions, please, as ever, let us know at avac.org. And I will remind you yet again that this call is part of our annual series, Research and Reality, based on AVAC Report by the same name. And stay tuned for the notice of the next call, which will be in a few weeks. And we look forward to ongoing critical advocacy for an AIDS vaccine and for the much larger AIDS prevention and treatment menu to be built out. So thank you all. Thank you again, Mary Maravich at NIAID and Bill Snow at the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise. And have great days, and let every day be a Vaccine Awareness Day. Thanks again.
Thanks so much.